military equipment and confront the networks operating in this field. Illegal immigration is not only a Libyan problem. Let me clarify that Libya is not a country for settling down, but is a transit country. In this matter, it's committed to what is required by the international laws regulating the matter. In addition, it rejects any form of dictations, interventions, or requirements that harm its interests, especially the rumors about the possibility of resettlement or something like that.
Thank you for that, Mr. Ambassador. Now, let's move to the oil sector in Libya. You know, Libya is an oil-rich country. And previously, I think in the 1970s or 80s, your production was almost 3.4 million barrels a day. And the current production stands only at 32% of its peak. And Libya, I think, is now 18th in the world in terms of oil production, despite its massive reserves. So what steps have you taken to boost oil production?
During the war, the sector has seen very difficulties, and it was natural at that time. In addition, this sector developed very rapidly. Because of the war, we fell behind in the international market, but we have a realistic plan right now in order to reopen, establish and develop oil fields and refineries.
Mr. Ambassador, we know Libya is an oil-rich country and it has some of the largest oil reserves in Africa, and it once produced 3.4 million barrels a day, but now the production has gone, has decreased significantly. What steps are you taking to increase this production?
During the war period, our energy sector was greatly damaged. This is normal because we were in the vortex of war. In addition, this sector is developing rapidly, and for that reason, we delayed it because of the war. The lack of maintenance of oil and gas refineries delayed us greatly in the energy market, but we have a realistic plan to redevelop and maintain the fields. Opening new refineries will return Libya to the top countries in energy exports.
Mr. Ambassador, now regarding the oil production issue, we know that Iran has attained a level of almost self-sufficiency in oil production. Now, do you plan to use the know-how of Iran in boosting your oil production instead of relying on oil multinationals from Western countries?
We welcome any cooperation with any friendly country, especially Iran, with which share a common history, and the things that unite us outweigh those that divide us with them. Of course, we hope to use the benefits of Iran's experience and try to transfer it to our country. We hope that the level of cooperation between us and Iran will reach this level as our cooperation with the friendly country Italy has.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, our last question. Recently, a Libyan delegation visited Beirut to discuss with the Lebanese authorities regarding the fate of a prominent Lebanese Islamic scholar, Imam Musa Sadr, who disappeared in Libya decades ago. Now, can you tell us more about the fate of this file and how much progress you have made in resolving it?
It is necessary to resolve this subject, especially since it is a legacy left behind by the previous regime. It's also important to develop relations with Lebanon, which we hope that calm and stability will prevail in it. As for the issue of Imam Musa al-Sadr, it is amongst the sensitive security subjects which we cannot reveal everything related to it at the moment, but what I can tell you is that the issue will be resolved soon, God willing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, for your time today and for answering our questions in this program. It's been a pleasure having you in our program.
Thank you. Merci. Khayli Mamnoun.
We had a special guest today, His Excellency Ali Juma Lubedi, the Ambassador of Libya to Iran. It's Bringate. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we're going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, let me start with this question, Sheikh. What's the rule if enjoining the good and forbidding the evil compromises the dignity of someone who fails to carry out an obligatory act or perpetuates a prohibited act and humiliates him before or in front of the people?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, enjoining the good and forbidding evil have certain conditions which must be fulfilled in order for a person to be able to fulfill this duty. In some cases it becomes obligatory, and some cases, of course, when the conditions are not met, one is not supposed to engage in enjoining good and forbidding evil, because it might have it is negative consequences. So we have to look at the consequences, or whether enjoining the good and forbidding evil has the desired impact or not. In the event that it will have its impact, of course we have to do it. Now, when it comes to compromising the dignity of someone, of course if one observes the condition and etiquette of enjoining the good and forbidding evil and does not transgress the limits, there is no problem, and one should do so, because amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar are obligatory duties which one should fulfill when it does not compromise, of course, on someone's dignity and esteem.
I see. Okay, well, Sheikh, is it a governmental ordinance or a fatwa that under the Islamic State that that the people's duty with respect to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil is limited to oral enjoining and forbidding, and the other grades, of course, are the responsibility of the authorities?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course it is a fatwa, it is a jurisprudential fatwa, that every individual should engage in enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, in promoting virtue and preventing evil. This is a duty which everyone has to fulfill when the conditions are propitious and when the situation is ripe.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to forbidding enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Well, Sheikh Javed, if forbidding evil with respect to, without the permission of the ruler, is it permissible without the permission of the ruler when, stopping someone from perpetuating evil depends on something like, for example, hitting that individual or imprisoning that individual or person or putting him or her to hardship, or on entering in, using, for example, that individual's properties, even if it is or it leads to their destruction?
Well, in the existence of an Islamic government or an Islamic establishment, these duties are the duties of an Islamic government. Because individuals cannot take the law in their hands and carry out these, for example, acts of imprisoning and in hitting some people, because one should not exceed one's limits in enjoining good and forbidding evil. So for enjoining good and forbidding evil are oral acts in terms of the individual obligation. But when one is required to, for example, to hit someone or imprison someone because of the crimes they commit, because of the, you know, the felonies they perpetrate, then it becomes the duty of the government and the government authorities to take action to stop someone from committing and perpetrating crimes. Because otherwise, if every individual takes action to hit someone, to imprison someone, or to carry out such things, there will be chaos, there will be lawlessness, and there will be mayhem, and that's not in the interest of the Islamic society.
Mm-hmm. Shastrovit, if forbidden evil with respect to very important matters, such as protecting the life of a respected person, in other words, to exclude the life of a murderer and the like, cannot be performed except through violence, such as hitting, which may cause injury or occasionally even killing of the assailant, will the permission of the authorized religious authority be required?
Well, if saving someone's life, someone's life, I mean the life of a person who is respected, who is Muslim, who is mu'min, and if preventing murder depends on immediate and direct intervention, it is quite permissible for that individual to go ahead. And it even becomes obligatory according to Islamic law, because if he does not jump into action to prevent someone or to protect someone's life, then that when the death occurs, then the religion does not consent to mm-hmm. that. The religion tells you to stop committing it, to prevent someone from committing such a grave and such a heinous crime, committing murder, which is a grave crime. And of course, the Holy Quran explicitly states that killing someone is equal to killing in the entire humanity. So it is necessary to take immediate action to stop someone from killing someone else.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to forbidding, enjoining the good and forbidding evil. Sheikh Javed, is it obligatory for someone who wants to enjoin another person to the good and forbids him from evil to have a special power to carry it out? When is it basically obligatory to enjoin, you know, the good and forbid the evil?
Well, first of all, it's important for the person enjoining good and forbidding evil to have good understanding of what is evil and what is good. Because unless you do not know what evil is and what good is, I think you will not be able to promote it, to promote good, to promote virtue, and to prevent evil.
So knowledge is first.
Knowledge is important. So whoever enjoins and forbids actually must know what the good and evil are, and he should know that the wrongdoer actually commits commits the wrong actions intentionally and without any, for example, legal excuse. So in that case, of course, if it becomes kind of obligatory to enjoin the good and forbidding evil, when of course it's likely that enjoining good has its effect.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are you yourself as in someone who is enjoining is you are secure from any kind of danger, because enjoining good should not involve any danger or it shouldn't entail any kind of harm for the person himself, because if it entails such a thing, then it's no longer obligatory to enjoin the good and forbid the evil.
I see. So first of all, you talked about knowledge and then power.
Power is necessary, and then the effect uh-huh. of the enjoining and
if there is no effect, or you expect no effect to be on the person who you enjoin to the good and forbid from evil,
then
it doesn't become necessary or obligatory.
And then also you yourself should be safe from any harm, because the other party who is prevented from evil,
I see,
should not attack you or cause any harm on you.
If someone like a relative, a close friend, continually commit sins, what should we do regarding our relationship with that individual?
Well, such people who commit felonies, they are sometimes good people, okay? And if you think that cutting relations may make your relative, your friend or relative, refrain from these sins, it will be obligatory for you to do so, to stay away from such people, to cut off or break off with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a way of enjoining the good and forbidding evil.
So if they become very much upset
and
take offense, what should we do? Should we still enjoin the good or forbid him from evil?
Well, this may be a natural consequence of enjoining someone and forbidding someone from evil. Because if you tell someone not to do it, he might take offense.
Yes.
So you don't have to care about it, because you are doing your duty and you don't know what is going on in his mind. Many people take offense, but we should do our duty of enjoining the good and forbidding evil. But when I want to tell another thing, and that is, we should not break off or break our ties with our kins and close relatives, like our parents, our children, our brothers and sisters, when enjoying the good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because Sila Rahim, which means maintaining relationship, keeping ties with our close relatives, is a duty. It's an act of virtue. We cannot, for example, skip one act of virtue for another, you know. So all of them are obligatory. But when it comes to close relatives, of course, we should not break ties with them.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Mr. Reed. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو
غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you. Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On a tense afternoon in Damascus on April 1st, Israel carried out a targeted airstrike on a building nestled within the Iranian embassy complex, sparking heightened tensions in the already volatile region. As smoke billowed from the damaged structure, questions swirled about the potential repercussions of this brazen act of aggression, casting a shadow of uncertainty over West Asia's geopolitical landscape. But why should Israel decide out of the blue to bomb Iran's embassy? What would be Tehran's reaction? Will the Islamic Republic seek direct and immediate retaliation? Or will it respond in its own fashion? Could Israel's strike be the tipping point into a wider regional conflict? These and more on this episode of Iran Today.
In the past few months, Israel has assassinated at least 18 members of the Quds Force, among them four senior commanders who were veterans of West Asia wars. But the airstrike in Damascus was far out of the ordinary, both in targeting so many senior figures at once and in hitting a diplomatic building, which is normally considered off-limits in conflicts.
This is Dr. Hossein Ajorlu, a senior expert on international relations based in Tehran.
این نکته هم تازه خدمت شما عرض کنم که مکانی که مورد هدف قرار گرفته کنسولگریه.
It's noteworthy that the place attacked by the Israeli regime is Iran's consulate. If attacking an embassy is a violation of international law, attacking a consulate is even a more flagrant violation. Because it's a place to give public services to ordinary people. So attacking such places is both a violation of international laws and human rights.
Among the seven Iranians assassinated were General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, one of Iran's most senior commanders in its Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, and Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi, his deputy. Mr. Abbas Haji Najjari told us about another aspect of Israel's attack.
Well, those who were martyred in the attack were Iran's official military advisors who were on Syrian soil in full coordination with the Syrian government. The Israeli regime violated international laws by targeting Iran's diplomatic mission, but also by violating the national sovereignty of Syria. Syria is not at war with Israel, so the regime cannot take such military action in the country. Iran reserves the right to target Israel directly or indirectly when and how Tehran will decide.
Martyr Zahedi oversaw the IRGC's operations in Syria, Lebanon, and Palestinian territories and fought on the front line with Hezbollah against Israel during the 2006 war, making him the most senior commander to be assassinated after martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Zahedi was attending a meeting with his officers and members of Islamic Jihad at the compound when the attack occurred.
What the Israeli regime did was an example of state terrorism, which is not even allowed in war conditions. It is not allowed even when two sides are at war with each other. The two sides of a conflict should abide by rules of engagement stipulated in international laws. So terrorism is a flagrant violation of international laws because you assassin a person without putting them on trial. It's totally unacceptable. On a higher level, what Israel did was meant to destabilize peace in the region, which itself is again against international laws. So Israel's attack on Iran's consulate building is illegal from different aspects.
Experts have described the attack as unprecedented and a dangerous escalation that threatens to finally tip Israel's six-month-long war with Hamas into a wider regional conflict. A day after Israeli airstrikes destroyed Iran's consulate building in Damascus, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei declared, "The evil regime will be punished by our brave men. We will make them regret this crime and other ones by God's will." A few days later on Friday, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in a televised speech, "Be certain that Iran's response to the targeting of its Damascus consulate is inevitable."
Iran has strongly condemned Israel's bombing of the building in the Iranian embassy complex in Damascus, denouncing it as a blatant act of aggression and a violation of international law.
The Islamic Republic has vowed to retaliate against Israel for the assassinating of senior commanders and other officers of its elite Quds force. Yet it has not disclosed the details of its planned retaliation or the timing of it. In several cities across Iran, including the capital Tehran, as well as Tabriz and Isfahan, large crowds of protesters gathered, waving Palestinian and Iranian flags and demanding revenge. "Our brave men will punish the Zionist regime," General Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, told the crowd in Tehran. "We warn that no act by any enemy against our holy system will go unanswered, and the art of the Iranian nation is to break the power of empires." Mr. Najjari said, "Unlike what it might seem, Iran's retaliatory response would contribute to peace in the region."
Iran's retaliatory attack or attacks might have a deterrent effect. If the Israelis come to this conclusion that their attacks are not cost-free, they might be more careful in the future. On the contrary, if we don't respond, it might embolden them not only to carry out attacks on Iran, but also on other countries in the region. Under such circumstances, we might, ironically, have further escalation.
Israel has placed its military on high alert, canceled leave for combat units, and recalled some reservists to air defense units. At the same time, 7 Israeli embassies have been evacuated in response to the potential threat of an Iranian retaliatory attack. The regime has deployed GPS jamming systems within Tel Aviv to safeguard against potential aerial attacks by Iran. The United States is anticipating a significant Iranian attack on U.S. or Israeli assets in a week or so.
"Look, Israel's attack on Iran's consulate cannot be described as a military achievement or military muscle flexing. An F-35 jet fighter targets a diplomatic building from the Golan Heights. So it is not correct to say that Israel has challenged Iran in military terms. It is not even correct to compare these two together. Israel might be at its maximum capacity, on par with Palestinian groups in terms of military prowess, and Iran does not need to attack Israel to prove its military superiority. If it attacks, however, it is for other considerations."
There are precedents for a forceful response by Iran. 4 years ago, after the United States assassinated the chief of the Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Iran fired missiles at U.S. bases in Iraq, injuring more tens of troops. Dr. Fouad Izadi of Tehran Faculty of World Studies had more to say.
How likely is the escalation of tensions?
Israelis have any sense left in them, they should take the response that Iran has and end it at that time. They should not respond to Iranians' response. If they do, this will escalate. Because, you know, even when General Soleimani was killed, Iran hit the American base in Iraq. And if Americans had responded, Iran had plans for Americans' response. Americans realized that continuing with that line was not good for them. So after they got hit at the base in Iraq, they stopped. They didn't continue. And Israelis should learn something from Americans. If they learn that, then you are not going to have serious escalation. If they continue with that practice, then we wouldn't know where the end is, because Iran cannot just get hit by Israelis and just live with that. That's not possible.
In the words of Lieutenant General Alexis Grinch Grinkovich, the top U.S. Air Force commander in West Asia, "From a military perspective, the biggest concern that I have is, does this lead to some sort of regional escalation?" Adding, "I do continue to assess that the Iranians are not interested in a broader regional conflict. They're not interested in war with Israel, war with the United States, or war with anybody else right now." That said, Iranian officials have vowed to retaliate against the unwarranted attack on their sovereignty and interests. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said, "Iran reserves the right to carry out a reaction and will decide on the type of response and the punishment of the aggressor."
In your opinion, what could be Tehran's best response?
"The Islamic Republic is not after war. All these diplomatic messages Tehran is sending here and there show that Iran wants to resolve tensions diplomatically. Moreover, when it comes to national interest, you must be patient. A tit-for-tat policy is not advisable when it comes to national security. Launching missiles is the easiest thing to do, but dealing a fatal blow to the enemy needs patience and deliberation. The Islamic Republic has shown that it responds to all threats but not right away, but in due time. To borrow from an Arab journalist, Iranians are patient people who take revenge in the right place at the right time.
For centuries, diplomatic premises have been afforded special protections. Diplomats get immunity from prosecution in their host country, and embassy buildings are often viewed as a sanctuary for their nation's citizens. They cannot be entered by the host country's police without the permission of the diplomatic staff, and often become refugees for expatriates in times of war. So, attacks on diplomatic compounds carry particular weight, both in law and in the popular imagination. Shortly after the attack, in addition to Syria, other Muslim countries like Iraq, Jordan, Oman, Pakistan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates were among the first to condemn the attack. Cuba, Venezuela, China, and Russia also slammed right away the Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy. Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement, "We strongly condemn this unacceptable attack against the Iranian consular mission in Syria." However, the so-called flag bearers of international law and conventions in the West have kept mum about Israel's flagrant violation of international law. Mr. Mohammad Qadiri, an Iranian political analyst, told us about the psychological warfare waged just after the attack.
Right after Israel's attack on Iran's consulate, all social accounts affiliated to Tel Aviv waged psychological warfare against the Islamic Republic. A few days ago, I came across a tweet by Netanyahu which was in Farsi. It was something like this: "Please put aside your strategic patience and take your severe revenge. He is desperately trying to both humiliate and instigate the Islamic Republic. This is clearly a psychological game. Again, what they're doing is a reaction to the fatal blows they've already received, and they cannot compensate by targeting some Iranian assets. Needless to say, Iran will hit back, but not the way the regime expects. It will do so with the least possible harm to the country."
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of the program. Here, we'll go over some important news headlines. Most Persian Gulf states condemned the attack on the Iranian embassy complex in Syria. An escalation is what they fear most. The Atlantic Council writes, from the perspective of many governments around the world, Israel moved up the escalation ladder when it raised Iran's embassy annex in Damascus on April 1st. Interestingly, the first country to condemn the airstrike was the United Arab Emirates. The leadership in Abu Dhabi has grave concerns about being caught up in any escalation of regional hostilities, which have been exacerbated since the Gaza War began in October 2023, and spread to Lebanon, Yemen, and elsewhere. The fact that the UAE normalized relations with Israel in 2020 via the Abraham Accords leaves the Persian Gulf country increasingly vulnerable to the Middle East conflict dynamics. US tells Iran it had no involvement in Israel's strike. Axios writes, the US told Iran that it had no involvement or advanced knowledge of an Israeli strike on a diplomatic compound in Syria that killed a senior Iranian general, according to a U.S. official. The rare message shows the Biden administration is deeply concerned that the Israeli strike could lead to a regional escalation and the resumption of attacks by pro-Iranian militia against U.S. forces. Israel and U.S. are on alert for Iran to strike back at Israel. New York Times writes, the Israeli airstrike in Damascus that killed seven Iranian commanders was an unusually harsh blow, and officials say Iran is determined to respond, raising fears of a war. U.S. military analysts assess that it is more likely that Iran would strike Israel itself than attack U.S. troops in the region, including in Iraq and Syria. Israel terrified of Iran's response to concealed attack. Iran's ambassador to Syria, Hossein Akbari, says that the Tel Aviv regime is frightened of Iran's response to the Israeli attack on the country's consulate in Damascus last week. Meher News writes, the senior Iranian diplomat made the comments while speaking at a ceremony at Iran's embassy in Damascus on the occasion of the International Quds Day, saying that Iran filed a complaint against Tel Aviv at the United Nations Security Council after the Israeli regime targeted the building of the country's consulate in Damascus and clearly violated all international law. Akbari underlined that since the United Nations Security Council failed to take necessary actions to prevent the repetition of such horrible crimes by the Zionist regime, Iran reserves its right to respond. Thank you for joining us in this section. Please stay tuned for the main narrative. Israel has long targeted Iran's military installations in Syria, but the April 1st attack was the first time it targeted the embassy compound itself.
The consequences of Israel's bombing of the building in the Iranian embassy complex in Damascus could be significant and wide-ranging. It could escalate tensions between Israel and Iran, potentially leading to retaliatory attacks from Iran against Israeli targets. This escalation could further destabilize an already volatile region and increase the risk of wider conflict. Moreover, the incident could strain diplomatic relations between Israel and other countries, particularly those with close ties to Iran. It may also lead to increased international scrutiny and condemnation of Israel's actions, potentially impacting its standing on the global stage. So the question is, why did Israel take such a risky action? Isn't it too big a gamble for too tiny a regime?
Why should Israel do this now? Basically, in what context did this attack take place?
Netanyahu realizes that as soon as this war is over, he will lose his prime ministership. So he wants to prolong the war. He wants to prolong the genocide in Gaza. He wants to expand the war to Syria and Lebanon and Iran. And, that's all he's interested in, to make sure that he remains prime minister. He's willing to kill as many Israelis and Iranians and Syrians and Lebanese and, as many people that needs to be killed. He doesn't care. He wants to be prime minister. And I think a lot of people realize that. And U.S. support for Netanyahu in the manner they have done in the last 6 months is, again, shows that people who are sitting in Washington don't realize what's good for them.
Mr. Qadiri told us that the attack is just Netanyahu's political sleight of hand.
It seems that the Israeli regime targeted Iran's consulate in Damascus in order to get away from public pressure coming from inside the occupied territories. After all, the regime is under relentless pressure as it has achieved no victory against the Palestinian resistance groups. Netanyahu has failed to achieve his stated goals so far. He said that he would seek the elimination of Hamas and the complete occupation of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime has just targeted defenseless people in Gaza, mostly women and children, which is not something to brag about. Last but not least, Netanyahu has not managed to release the Israelis held captive by Hamas and other resistance groups. So the Israeli Prime Minister is seeking to change the playground by doing such frenzied things, which are not correct either politically or militarily.
Israel's recent attack on Iran's embassy, coupled with the regime's recent destructive actions in Gaza, has intensified global concerns about Israel's approach to conflict resolution and its impact on regional stability. The targeted strike on Iran's diplomatic mission not only signals a dangerous escalation of hostilities between the two sides, but also raises questions about Israel's broader strategic objectives.
What is happening right now in the occupied territories is threatening the very existence of the Israeli regime. It's a matter of life and death for the regime. That's while up until October the 7th, the regime used to be full of itself, considering itself to be the epitome of power and success. Up to that moment, the regime used to brag about its great deterrence in all aspects, such as security, military, cybersecurity, and intelligence. But this masquerade has now been shattered into pieces, a humiliating debacle for the regime. So it is quite understandable why the Israelis are behaving this way.
By attacking a diplomatic facility, Israel has crossed a significant line in international norms, further solidifying its reputation as a pariah regime. As the world waits to see how Tehran will respond to this provocation, the specter of direct confrontation looms large. Yet it's not easy to Tehran's mind.
What is Israel looking for?
ایالات متحده آمریکا در چند وقت اخیر یه چیزی نشون داده که حامی رژیم صهیونیستی است.
The United States of America has shown over and over again that it supports Israel unconditionally. We have seen this even after all the regime's genocidal operations. But the Israelis want even more support from Washington. They want the U.S. to directly support their interest by, let's say, dispatching its troops to the battlefield. The Israelis think if they manage to drag Tehran to the war, the Americans would get themselves engaged directly. But I would like to say that the Islamic Republic is acting very cleverly. The way Tehran is responding shows that it's fully aware of the whole game. So Israel wants to transform its war with Hamas into an international war against the resistance front, but to no avail.
The recent attack on Iran's diplomatic mission by Israel raises concerns about the regime's potential efforts to expand the scope of the conflict, dragging both Iran and U.S. into it, in fact pitting the two against each other.
You know, Israel has been wanting to have a war between Iran and the United States for many years, dating back to the 1990s. They want to have a military confrontation between Iran and the United States. They want to fight Iran using American soldiers. That's what they want. They are hoping by attacking Iranian consulate, maybe they can start that war. So that's one aim they have.
Some believe the embattled prime minister of the regime is acting as the madman. The madman theory is a political strategy where a leader deliberately portrays themselves as irrational and unpredictable to intimidate their adversaries. It is often used to gain leverage in negotiations or conflicts. By appearing erratic and volatile, Netanyahu may hope to instill fear and uncertainty in Iran's decision makers, leading them to reconsider their stance on certain issues. But the chances done seem to be high enough.
Want to say we are strong, we can do anything, we're above all international law. They call it the madman theory. We are madmen. We can engage in any type of genocide, we can engage in any type of violation of international law. This is the new normal. This is what the Israeli leaders are saying. The new normal is Israelis can do anything and they can get away with anything. And so the world needs to get used to that. The good news is that the more engaged they engage in this type of illegal activities, the more the genocide in Gaza continues, the deeper they get into this mess that they got themselves into. Now they have gotten themselves into a bigger mess, and now they're confronting Iran, which is a big mistake, because Iranian military capability is quite extensive. And Iranian leaders, I believe, have decided to respond to this grave violation of international law and the killing of Iranian generals and other personnel that they had on the ground in the consulate.
The desperate attack on Iran's embassy can yet reveal cracks within the Israeli regime. Political leaders in Israel may also use tensions with Iran to rally public support and divert attention from domestic issues.
اشخاصی مثل نتانیاهو و کابینه دست راستی اون
People like Netanyahu and his extremist cabinet desperately need war. If you look at the short history of the Israeli regime, you will find out that after crushing defeats, the sitting prime minister and his men are usually put on trial or find their political future completely ruined. Netanyahu knows that his days are numbered, and sooner or later he will be kicked off the Israeli political stage. So he is trying to prolong the war, hoping that he might be able to achieve some victories in war, so as to increase his chances for survival in the political sphere of the regime. At the same time, Netanyahu has found himself against a nullified front in the region. Almost all the countries in the region are critical of the regime's genocide in Gaza. By introducing a new actor, namely Iran, to the theater of Gaza, Netanyahu wants to cause division in the unified front. After all, Iran has both friends and foes in the region, and Netanyahu is seeking to capitalize on this issue to his own interest.
Since October 7th, Israel has lost its proclaimed reputation as a regime with an invincible army. In a series of blatant, insane, and destructive moves, Israel has just escalated tensions to its own detriment. These actions paint Israel as a global pariah, ready to do anything to survive. As the clock ticks, the world watches anxiously, wondering how Tehran will respond to Israel's aggression.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again to see what else is on. Till next time, take care.
In the limelight.
The deliberate targeting of Gaza health infrastructure, manufactured scarcity of medical supplies and fuel, and restricted access to basic necessities are all different means through which the destruction of healthcare has been used as a weapon of war by the child killer regime of Israel. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned, please. Crescent International wrote, "The Zionist regime army has been relentless in its targeting of healthcare workers and infrastructure in Gaza. This is not a new strategy employed by the Zionist regime. Health has, for years, been previously documented as being used as a weapon against the occupied Palestinian population. While this is not a novel concept in modern-day warfare, we have not seen the tactic used on such a large scale to strangulate a population before. The deliberate targeting of health infrastructure, manufactured scarcity of medical supplies and fuel, and restricted access to basic necessities are all different means through which the destruction of healthcare has been used as a weapon of war. With these actions, the Zionist regime seeks to amplify the scale of human losses inflicted on civilians in the Gaza Strip and push the survivors into exodus." Prior to October 7, 2023, healthcare system in Gaza were already teetering on the brink, with only 36 hospitals operating as full capacity and a total of 3,412 beds catering to a population exceeding 2 million people. This data indicates a maximum ratio of 1.55 hospitals beds per 1,000 individuals across the entire region. Patients requiring access to specialized treatment outside of Gaza have routinely been prevented from exiting. In 2021 alone, over 36% of requests for medical permits were either refused or left unanswered by Israeli occupation authorities, condemning patients with urgent conditions to preventable deaths. In January this year, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs released the statistics related to the medical situation being faced in Gaza due to the unrelenting Israeli aggression. 337 healthcare workers have been martyred. 145 UN staff have been killed. 14 of 36 hospitals in Gaza are only partially functional, and they suffer from outages and major shortages of medical supplies. 26 of 36 hospitals in Gaza are damaged. 122 ambulances have been damaged. 1.9 million Gaza residents are displaced. The numbers are shocking, and the extent of damage is unfathomable, difficult to comprehend through numbers alone. By November 2023, all hospitals in northern Gaza were completely out of service. It was at this point that we witnessed the Zionist regime leading armed invasions of hospitals, including the largest medical complex in the region, Ash-Shifa, and the Indonesian hospital, which at the time was the last remaining operational hospital in northern Gaza. This demonstrates a sustained and orchestrated Israeli policy to destroy healthcare facilities, forcing their evacuation. Despite claims by the Zionist regime army that armed Palestinian groups have used health facilities for military purposes, according to Human Rights Watch, no evidence has yet been presented that provides legal justification for the loss of the protected status of hospitals and other health infrastructure as codified by international humanitarian law. An extensive Washington Post investigation of the Zionist regime's attacks and invasion of Ash-Shifa Hospital found that the evidence provided by Israel does not demonstrate that the hospital was being used as a command and control center, nor that the hospital building is connected to a larger tunnel network. Notably, the burden of proof remains with the accuser to provide adequate evidence that the protected status of a health facility has been lost. In case of doubt, there should be a presumption of civilian status. If a health facility loses its protected status, the principles of proportionality, precaution, and distinction still apply. Despite these clear international laws, the destruction of the healthcare system has been the main thrust of the Zionist occupation army's clear strategy. Repeated patterns of these attacks indicate that damages inflicted on Gaza's already precarious health system and the systematic murder of medical staff are part of a broader strategy seeking to weaponize healthcare. Despite these clear international laws, the destruction of the healthcare system has been the main thrust of the Zionist occupation army's clear strategy. Beyond overt destruction, UNICEF released its report number 20, documenting the broader health-related impacts being suffered by the civilian Gaza population. They include high levels of displacement and overcrowding in collective centers and scattered sites in the Gaza Strip continue with extremely challenging hygiene and sanitation conditions. On average, 340 individuals share one toilet and 1,290 persons share one shower. The babies of 5,500 women who are due to give birth in the next month in the Gaza Strip are at risk of dying, as their mothers do not have access to prenatal or postnatal checkups because of bombings and need to flee for safety. Anxiety is also leading to premature births, as reported by the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA. Over 90% of children aged 6 to 23 months and pregnant, breastfeeding women face severe food poverty with access to two or fewer food groups per day. In addition, withdrawal of fuel and power sources and the